Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Flicks the Church Forgot. This is the second episode in a multi-part episode that's exploring demon possession movies. Look at episode one if you want a review of The Exorcist from 1974 and the Turkish version called Satan. But today we're going to be looking at two more entries into the infamous demon possession canon.
Who are you?
Beyond the door. A terrifying look into demonic possession.
George, you can help me, George. Take me away from here.
Mommy! Mommy!
Beyond the door. Step inside, if you dare.
Egyptian movie producer Ovidio Asantis was involved in some 70s and 80s Nature Goes Wild movies like Tentacles and Piranha 2, The Spawning. But back in 1974, he also directed a demon possession movie called Beyond the Door, in which he was credited as Oliver Hellman. And that was successful enough to be the number one movie in the US at the time. Roger Ebert even had to write a review on it, saying that it was trash, but at least it was scary trash, he said. It even spawned an unofficial sequel. While the inspiration for The Exorcist can hardly be denied on this film, Beyond the Door is actually an intriguing and at times pretty unsettling horror movie. It's also known by the Italian title of Chi Sei, I don't know if that's the right way of saying it, which my Italian friend tells me means, who are you? Even though I quite like this film, reviewers like Nicholas Schreck describe it as execrable, and if you flick through the various online reviews, it doesn't have very much love, or at least as much as I expected. In the film, Juliette Mills plays Jessica Barrett, who lives in San Francisco, and she's a married woman whose affair with a Satanist called Dimitri comes back to haunt her, or rather to possess her. The film's an interesting case study in intellectual property in that, due to the subject matter, Beyond the Door was seen as a direct ripoff of The Exorcist, and so Warner Brothers filed a lawsuit saying that it infringed on their copyright. They did this with Abby, the blaxploitation movie, which we're going to look at later as well. But with regard to Beyond the Door, it was eventually decided that Warners didn't really have the intellectual property rights on scenes similar to The Exorcist, because after all, The Exorcist was a film itself depicting a supposed real-life case. And so in a sense, Beyond the Door perhaps paved the way for the demonic possession movie as a genre. If it had been prosecuted and The Exorcist movies had ended up owning the cinematic future of possession, then we probably wouldn't have had all the demonic possession movies we see today. Or we would have, but Warner Brothers would be a little bit richer. Perhaps the authorities also noticed that while it shares some of the possessed person tropes, I mean, the Beyond the Door does, you know, normally nice person starts saying nasty things on a bed, the film itself is actually quite different, and it's a lot more trippy and, I would say, experimental than The Exorcist. We find that Jessica is pregnant with her third child, and when she tells her husband, he says something like, you know what that means, they outnumber us now, they could attack us with knives. He says something really bizarre like that. Anyway, neither of them seem super happy about having a third child, and she considers an abortion, but then all of a sudden she's like not wanting to do that anymore, and she's getting very defensive about the child that's living inside her. And as the pregnancy deepens, Julie starts developing strange mannerisms and characteristics, and soon her first two children are saying that mummy is giving them the creeps. Not least when she starts making the room shake, and I think if I recall this right, her head does spin round, like you do have that classic moment, but this time it's when she's lying on a bed and the look on her face is pretty unsettling. Throughout all of this, we keep hearing the name Dimitri. In fact, I would say that I have never ever heard the name Dimitri said quite as many times as I have when I've seen this movie. She just has this wild, low-voiced outbursts all the time. Roger Ebert said she sounds like the Big Bopper, and she just keeps going on, Dimitri, Dimitri, oh, Dimitri, like over and over again. Anyway, it turns out that Dimitri is an old friend from her past who comes into the situation, and the husband, Robert, is very understanding about it. In fact, he sees Dimitri as potentially the only one who can really help his wife and her crazy ways. However, we the audience know better. In the opening scenes, we're told that Dimitri has some weird connection with Satan. In exchange for the longevity of life, he's made some sort of deal with the devil, and part of the deal is to deliver this baby into the world. So that's what we're given at the beginning of the film. And so as we can see, this is a very different storyline to The Exorcist, which gives Beyond the Door an edge over some similar demonic possession ripoff movies. And there's a facepalm feeling to the way the husband, Robert, acts so naively towards Dimitri. I mean, at one point, the guy turns up and says, you know, he wants to be in the house with Robert's wife. And Robert is like, okay. And Dimitri is like, no, I need to be alone with your wife. And we know that she's currently in the other room, lying on a bed, waiting for Dimitri. And Robert, her husband's like, yeah, right, fair enough. I'll go out for a walk. And I mean, the guy is a picture of understanding in this. And I started thinking, wow, if Jessica was simply having an affair with Dimitri again, this would be the perfect cover story. You know, just to act possessed and get the lover from your past to act like he's the only one who can stop it by basically being in your room while you act overtly sexual, quote, against your will, end quote. They've come up with quite a clever idea for covering adultery, but this is not really what's happening. There really is something even more intense going on. There's devil possession at work. What's interesting, too, is that both Robert and Dimitri himself will be recognizable to horror fans. Robert is played by Gabriel Lavia, the Italian actor who plays a very different role as the transvestite Carlo in Dario Argento's Profondo Rosso, also known as Deep Red. He also played a different character with the same name, Carlo, in Inferno as well. And he's quite fun in this. I quite like him. He looks a little bit like Wilbur Whately, played by Dean Stockwell in the Dunwich Horror from the late 60s, is it? I think it is. Anyway, Dimitri is played by the English actor Richard Johnson, who you might recognize from 1963's classic scary haunted house movie, The Haunting. Or you'll recognize him from Lucio Fulci's Zombie Flesh Eaters from 1979. He's still acting today, actually, and you see him crop up in the UK from time to time. Impressive, seeing as the bloke was born in 1927. Juliet Mills, who plays Jessica, is also a TV regular who's cropped up in anything from Love Boat to Dynasty to Columbo, and is currently in an American sitcom called Hot in Cleveland, with, I think, Betty White's in that, too. I always like it when you discover TV actors who appear in mild-mannered family fare like Fantasy Island or Murder, She Wrote, two things that Juliet Mills was in. I like it when you see them in roles in their past that are really exploitation out there. And Juliet's portrayal of the possessed Jessica is really out there. It's quite unsettling at times. And there are moments in this film that do, I think, feel insidious and creepy. Like, there's a part when the mother, Jessica, goes into her young son's room and finds him sleeping in bed, and she slowly leans over him, and you think, oh no, what's she going to do? She's going to hurt him or something. And then she kisses him on the lips, but as he sleeps, she does it, like, for way longer than you're supposed to. And it's a great reminder of that scene in The Innocents with Deborah Kerr, when she kisses the ghostly reincarnation of that little boy, and there's a lingering feeling that is just disturbing and a little shocking. That happens here. But also, Juliet is great at pulling some really crazed faces. In Satan, the kid who played Ghoul tried her best to look scary into the camera, but she comes across as a child gurning and growling for fun. But here, though, Julie, played by Jessica, well, Jessica's demonic gurning actually got under my skin. Like, when she's having an encephalogram and she's just looking really whacked out all the time. And her voice is really horrible, and it reminds me of one of those scenes in Dario Argento's Suspiria, which always freaks me out. One of my favorite Dario Argento film. It's absolutely magnificent, that movie. And at the end of Suspiria, when Susie Banyan, played by Jessica Harper, is standing by a door, you remember that bit? Right at the very end, when this voice is saying something like, "Death comes now! Death comes now!" It's just really horrible, and the door flings open and this giggling barbed wired slashed monstrosity comes in holding a knife. Man, that's the sort of thing that would make me drop a brick if I saw it happening in real life. And Jessica's voice in this sometimes has the tinge of that Suspiria voice. You know, the guy with the eyes here. It's like, whoa, you're crazy. And somehow I think the dubbing, the fact that this is dubbed, makes it somehow even more scary. Like the unreality of it, the melodrama. You know, I enjoy watching these dubbed films, especially the Italian ones. The indoor work here was filmed in Italy. Because the way the voices are overdubbed might make some viewers snigger and assume it's bad quality, but for me it sort of adds a sort of dreamlike quality to it. It's not dubbed like a sort of Japanese, like, fighting movie or something. You know, the words pretty much fit their mouths, but it's just, you know, it's overdubbed because they didn't really record all of the voices at the time. And so it's got that classic Italian horror movie sort of vibe to it, even though it's set in America mostly in the outdoor shots. Anyway, I digress. The film Beyond the Door is also notable for its offbeat and sometimes art house style. Like, the opening sequence, I think, is really unique. We have a black screen with a well-spoken, articulate English voice who sounds, frankly, a lot like C-3PO, directly addressing the audience. And he's talking about stuff like, "I'm going to be the star of the upcoming picture, though, of course, I won't be seen. And I know that you're living in a rational world, but it's an illusion." It's just like talking like that at the beginning. And then in time, the audience, you're going to discover the reality of horror in your midst, all this sort of stuff. And he wants to tell this little story. And if we haven't guessed it already, we later discover that the voice who introduces this film is the devil himself, politely inviting us into his world. It's almost like he's showing us his holiday video. You know, this is what I got up to last week. I tormented this family. Woohoo! Hope you enjoy it. And all the while, this ethereal analog synth pad is growing and growing as the devil talks. And I was thinking as I watched this, yeah, this is different. This is cool. I'm liking it. And there's some nice camera trickery too. At one point, the image hovers over Jessica's face and we suddenly see one of her eyes moving independently to the other one. Now, this effect would be done a lot more and with a lot less subtlety in 2012's The Possession, which we're going to be looking at later. But that was a much less shocking effect, despite the use of state-of-the-art CGI. In this, it just sort of looks quite creepy, even though I know that's just a camera trick. It's really still good. Speaking of camera work, there's excellent use of freeze frames in Beyond the Door. Every now and then, perhaps when Jessica touches her husband's face or something, the camera freezes or pauses for maybe half a second and then carries on. And it's like the director is saying, something just happened in that moment that's significant. Something invisible and unseen, but something spiritually dangerous. And it's a sort of effect that I'd sort of forgotten was possible. And because you don't really see it in many films. And I do wonder if some modern filmmakers should try using it. Like James Wan, for example, he did some cool little jump cuts to the faces of some of the ghouls in the Beyond the Graveland called The Further in Insidious. And so, you know, I think he would probably enjoy doing little things like that now and again. So much horror effects these days are about computer manipulation of images, yet Beyond the Door reminded me of how creative stylistic editing can add unexpected power and fear to a moment. And there is this odd bookending with the imagery that I really loved, particularly in the very final shot of the movie with a boy on a boat. He opens up a gift, and I'm not going to tell you what's inside, but when I saw it, it felt so appropriate and right, and I didn't expect to see what was in there. I remember saying out loud, "That's a cool ending," when I was watching it, even though I don't fully understand it. At the end of Beyond the Door, you're left with the impression that the devil, as portrayed through the medium of Jessica, is an all-out sadist, especially when it's revealed that his motivation is at the end. Much like we see in the blaxploitation exorcist movie Abby, the devil comes across in this as just getting a massive kick out of being horribly cruel. And what I like about the film is that the script even tries to put a reason for the cruelty on this. At one point, Jessica is thrashing about on her bed, plunging her family into full-on satanic panic, but then she turns her head and gives this unusually sympathetic speech for what demons who possess others have to go through. She says something like, "Pain," she says, "what do you know of pain? The sweet pain of endless hatred, the loneliness of living in another's body, knowing you will never be yourself. Nobody knows the exquisite suffering of the damned, but you will, when you finally die, you will die in my image and I give you eternal damnation." It's like, I'm not really sure what it all means, but what a thought-provoking idea that demons might experience a horrible loneliness living in another person's body because they are restricted from truly being themselves. I was like, wow, I'd never even considered that. Overall, Beyond the Door gets some terrible reviews online, but I really liked it because it has a unique spin at a time when The Exorcist had only just come out. Before exorcism films really would start looking like each other, it was quite nice to see such a fresh take on it so soon after the film had come out. The last words in the film I leave to its director, Ovidio Asantis. He says this: "All in all, I am sadly aware that my contributions to the horror genre are not of such historical relevance as, say, The Exorcist or Psycho. We're not talking masterpieces here, but I have put all my love and enthusiasm into my films, and I think it shows. What's most important is I've gained the respect of true horror fans who are always loyal and extremely perceptive. They know a good film when they see one."
I'll have them back Sunday.
Just healthy food, okay? No pizza?
Give you $5 if you don't tell your mother.
Make it 35.
Dad, you need dishes.
Cool.
Well, that's weird. There aren't any seams.
What does that mean?
Whoever made this didn't want anybody to open it.
Are you okay?
I feel funny.
Have you noticed anything odd with Emily?
Slow down!
It says Dybbuk. It's the Hebrew word for demon.
What does this thing want with my daughter?
The spirit is the taker of children.
Who am I?
I'm all here for you.
Once in a box, it's open.
People die.
You let my daughter go!
I saw something in her.
Possession. Rated PG-13. In theaters August 31st.
Moving on now to The Possession from 2012. This is a film that I've spotted on my Netflix screen under one of those headings that say, "We think you will like The Possession." And it's directed by a Danish director called Ole Nørnar Dahl and produced by Sam Raimi. Now, supposedly it's based on a true story, and it still follows pretty much the same trajectory as The Exorcist and all the other demon possession movies, in that, a little girl or a female starts acting offensive and violent. The father starts to realize that there's something more than mental illness or teenage angst going on, and she ends up getting full-on possessed. Now, it probably goes without saying that this is nowhere near in the league of The Exorcist, and it lacks the left-field invention of a film like Beyond the Door. However, it's notable for a few reasons, not least because it's one of the few Jewish exorcism films I've seen, though not actually the only one. Basically, the horror kicks off when Clyde Brennick's daughter, Emily, spots an old wooden box at a yard sale. Emily turns out to have unusual tastes as a kid, and rather than bug her dad for a One Direction t-shirt, she actually wants to have this strange box with Hebrew inscriptions on it. And when she takes it home, she hears whispering coming from inside the box, which is quite creepy, and when she eventually cracks it open, bad move, she finds a bunch of weird paraphernalia, including a dead moth. And the moth is going to become a symbol of all things demonic in this. The box, it turns out, is housing a Dybbuk. Now, if you're not aware of what exactly a Dybbuk is, it's not to be confused with the Babadook, that's another film. But rather, the Dybbuk is found in Jewish folklore and is the ghost of a troubled soul that comes to possess the body of a living person. The word Dybbuk means clinging spirit in Yiddish, which is kind of a creepy image, don't you think? That you have the spirit of a disturbed ghost literally clinging onto you. Longtime listeners of this podcast will probably be aware that the Dybbuk was discussed in a podcast I did on a horror movie called The Unborn from 2009. But I guess enough time, a couple of years had passed in Hollywood for people to have another go with a Dybbuk, and The Possession is it. Now, the actual nature and characteristics of the Dybbuk in folklore is quite slippery in sort of Jewish thinking, because the various different stories are about them. You know, it's quite hard to work out a consistent narrative about them. For example, in some circles, the Dybbuk can come and possess any living thing. So perhaps an animal or even a blade of grass. I mean, can you imagine that? A demonic possession movie about a man whose back garden needs an exorcism. And they can be exorcised by a righteous man. I don't know if a righteous woman would work. I don't know enough about Jewish folklore to say, but what I read about it was a righteous man can sort this out, and might even enlist the help of another disembodied spirit called a Magid, that's a sort of nice Dybbuk, or might even call in an angel to help. So anyway, it's this angle that makes the possession a little bit more interesting, just because it's fun learning about other traditions and the horrors that they hold. And for a while at least, the film held my attention. For example, I like the fact that when Clyde goes to get advice from a folklore professor about this possession stuff, the guy is just treating it like a big joke, and he's acting like the stuff is just a big bunch of crap, and he's like laughing in his face, and I just quite enjoyed that sort of response. And I also like how the build-up in the film does feature, I think, some fairly tense scenes. The symbology of the moth, for example, representing the Dybbuk, was a nice touch, and there are some good uses of sound in the film, particularly the moments where the director drops out all sound effects altogether and plays only music over the tense scenes. It's a pretty good score, actually. And he does that now and again, which I think is a pretty neglected technique of dropping out all sound effects and just putting pure soundtrack on. But when he does it, I reckon it works quite well. Plus, he frames things in a way that Stanley Kubrick sometimes might have, with wide shots of symmetrical and wide clinical corridors. And so you've got, every now and again, a nice stylized vibe about it. It's the subtle moments I liked in this too, like the scene where the dad walks into Emily's room and she's looking at a mirror into the Dybbuk box, and it's grimy and it's thick with aged dirt and you can't fully make it out, but it looks, or it appears, that her reflection has no pupils anymore, just the whites of the eyes, which is a classic sign of possession according to the experienced exorcists. And I think that was quite a cool little touch, because it was subtle and you weren't really sure what's happening. However, the film has a tendency to just skip through some of this subtlety and then take other scenes just way too far, which means that there's just too much reliance on CGI in this film, which for me is just a surefire way of sapping out the real-world horror of a moment. For example, the thing with the moths is creepy. I get that. But then, when we jump to a scene of a possessed girl happily sitting in her bed while thousands of moths race around her, I just thought, that's obviously not happening. And that's obviously supposed to be a big shock, you know, clutch your boyfriend and girlfriend moment in the cinema, but I was just a bit meh with those scenes. And other scenes where you see strange things coming up from inside the mouth and all that stuff is all like very, ooh, that's weird. But I don't know, it's you just know it's built in a computer over a series of weeks, and it just didn't really work too much for me. Another moment is when a teacher takes the Dybbuk box and then, let's say, learns of its power, and there's a potential for creepy subtlety, but things go full-on gonzo crazy, and that might be a big jump in the cinemas, but feels a bit too comic book to be scary for me. And again, CGI is way overused in scenes where people's eyeballs swivel in their heads. Okay, so it would be pretty damn terrifying to see that happening in real life, but they do it in such a full-on wriggle that iris type of way that your brain checks out of it, and it's just sort of amusing, or at best gross out. Not unsettling like the single eye shifting in Beyond the Door. Now, I may be wrong, but I've got a theory. I do wonder if Sam Raimi might be the type of producer who pushes his directors into high-octane choices that they might otherwise have rejected. You see, you know, you've seen most of his, many of his horror movies are sort of like horror slapstick. And they're great, you know, but I wonder if he pushes that into his producing advice into films like this that I think would have been better if they'd been a little bit more subtle. But hey, loads of films do this, so not necessarily Sam Raimi's fault. Also, what doesn't help is the young girl herself. Bless her, she does her best, but she's just not that scary. And it doesn't help that the filmmakers decide not to go all Reagan McNeil and slash her face up, you know. She just has this twisty eye thing going on with very minimal makeup, and occasionally her hair blows around like she's in some sort of 80s rock video. So, there are problems to this. Yet, as well as the novel Jewish angle, the film does have another secret weapon in the lead actor, which is Jeffrey Dean Morgan. Now, most people perhaps know him for his roles in Watchmen or Grey's Anatomy, but he's an actor that I always get mixed up with his sort of more creepy-looking brother, almost. Javier Bardem, the Spanish actor who played the baddie in Skyfall and the crazy killer in No Country for Old Men. But anyway, I quite like Jeffrey Dean Morgan. There's a sort of reality to him which comes across pretty well in this, though there are a few times, admittedly, when he overacts and the reality part feels pushed away. You know, who knows, maybe Raimi was off camera even in those scenes saying, "More tears, Jeffrey, ramp that sucker up!" Anyway, what I liked about this was the situation that Morgan finds himself in, namely being a divorced dad who's having his daughter come on weekend visits, so that when she starts to go crazy with the Dybbuk in her, He figures, you know, he'll just go ahead and do an exorcism himself. Basically, his ex-wife and new partner are thinking that Morgan is, like, off his head. He's doing something really crazy and bad and being a bad influence on his children. And this is seen best in a really great and comfortable moment when the possessed daughter stands in front of Jeffrey Dean Morgan's character while an invisible hand is slapping her. But the older sister is at the other end of the corridor and can just about see it, and it looks like the dad is slapping the daughter, which he isn't. But then the girl who was possessed is starting to scream out, "No, why are you doing this? Stop hitting me!" And you just think, oh man, that situation would absolutely suck. By the time we get to Morgan stomping about the Jewish quarter with his dibbuk box and a sports bag enlisting funky young rabbis to help him out, it starts turning a little bit silly, and the final exorcism showdown in the sports rehab center of a hospital is notable mainly because they make a heck of a lot of noise and nobody in the building seems to notice. And also there are moments when they're holding down this little girl and Morgan is shouting at her for the dibbuk to come out, and you think, yeah, right, loud shouty exorcism, that's exactly what's needed in this situation because she's clearly possessed by a crazy mothborn spirit. But there was a moment when I just stepped out of it and went, thought, wow, this sort of stuff happens with some people for real, even young kids in the sort of the real life exorcism tales, and you know that the people doing it believe that it's for real, and yet, you know, it just felt like horrific abuse and persecution if it wasn't real. And we'll discuss more of the potential dangers, of course, of exorcism in the final episode. So in short then, I think The Possession does have some good things going for it, not least that it mixes up the possession hero top trumps and sticks a rabbi in there, but I'm not surprised to find so many mixed reviews of the film online. For example, many call it generic trash, while others, including the late Roger Ebert, called it one of the better Exorcist ripoffs. Well, it's worth queuing up on your watch list anyway. Give it a try. And that brings us to the end of another episode exploring demonic possession. Join me in the third episode where I'm going to be looking at two films, Deliver Us from Evil from 2014 and also the infamous Abby from 1974. But until then, don't forget the flicks the church forgot.
Yeah.